Welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. Today we're speaking with Radhika Gajala about cyberfeminism and with Sophie Ashraf about online content creation. I'm your host, Ian Cook. I don't know how old you all feel when you think about the internet, but this week I felt both wonderfully young and then disconcertingly old. That's not just because my two guests this month are from generations above and below me, but because of the way they talk about the internet. Our first guest, Radhika Gajala, who gives us this month's concept, cyberfeminism, was researching feminist spaces online back when they were hard to find in the early days of the internet. Meanwhile, our second guest, this month's online god, Sophie Ashraf, has to work hard to get her feminist and other political messages heard amidst the sheer volume of content online today. As ever, both parts of our podcast, the concept and then the online god section, speak to wider issues of digital dignity, a concept and a project developed by Sahan Udupa at LMU in Germany. And the podcast is also published in cooperation with the HOW Network for Ethnographic Theory. Let's get on with the show. So our first guest is Radhika Gajala, and Radhika is Professor of Media and Communication at Bowling Green State University in the US, where she works on cybercultures, feminist ethnographies, and also microfinance online, philanthropy, and neoliberal entrepreneurship. And we're really happy to have her on the podcast. So let's dive straight in to one of the key terms you've worked with. That's the term of cyberfeminism. It's been around for quite a while, but I was wondering how you define it.
Cyberfeminism is the access to technology by women and the use of technology for their self-empowerment. You're right in that it's been around for quite a while, and so have I been around for quite a while. So I encountered the term in the 1990s when I was in grad school, and was pretty much, I think it was at that time, it was the Lisproc era, and was involved with this project for doing Lisprocs on feminism, post-feminism, and all the other, and Marxism and post-colonial theory, and in the Spoon Collective. And so I was engaged with that. And then I was dabbling with others who were online in Muds and Moos. And I think one of those places was called the Old Boys Network, as a kind of a satirical turn. It was actually a feminist network. So I encountered the word feminism while hanging out in all these spaces, in these Lisproc spaces, and I thought it's interesting.
That's wonderful. And so with something like cyberfeminism, we've been exploring a lot in this podcast the offline world and how it interacts with the online world. And I was wondering, specifically related to cyberfeminism, how do these two worlds speak to one another?
The online and offline becomes kind of unnecessary-ish now with digital feminism, in the sense that people use these tools in their daily life, and is that a valid binary anymore? And I think other digital feminists, and this is the term I think a lot of people are using, digital feminism, because cyber has become a bit of an old-fashioned thing. And I think these generations, the generation of feminists online view the technology as an extension of themselves, and it's their everyday life, in the sense that there's a lot of young women now using these public spaces online to build community, build support structures. This is exactly the actualization of the cyberfeminism that was being fought for. I actually started off a disclaimer. I started off actually looking at cyberfeminism skeptically, because I felt that a lot of women in those times were saying, "Oh, access to the computer, and then our lives will be better." And And for me, coming from a developing world context, I couldn't quite see how this different hierarchy was going to make everything suddenly better for women or women everywhere. So it became my entry point became a questioning of the politics of cyberfeminism, of the class, and at that time Global North location. But of course, I was myself individually experiencing the euphoria and autonomy of being connected. It was so the contradictions of cyberfeminism from a personal vantage point, when you can connect from home with a child at home and then do all kinds of things in public space-ish, things that I probably wouldn't have done if I didn't have the internet. And then the idea that cyberfeminism should apply to all, which kind of was a reproduction of how I feel like liberal feminists, celebration of middle class homemaker autonomy, all of a sudden saying, oh, you know, everyone can be free. And then you're looking around and saying the histories of slavery, histories of caste. And then the more recently, and of course the hierarchies in places like India, where you have cultures of servitude. So on whose shoulder does any particular woman's autonomy stand on? At that time, I think the prevalent discourse question around ICTs, computer-mediated communication, was somehow, I think there was this assumption that this new technology was available, everybody was connecting, therefore somehow women from the developing world will just kind of adopt it and become empowered. I think now I would turn around seeing what's happening in the social media. It's a totally different scenario, yet empowerment is the buzzword. It's a kind of, a way that nonprofits and for-profit corporate philanthropy sector and others use as a branding technique. Mm-hmm. We will empower you. We will empower all these people. And so buy my product. And then, of course, the NGO sector it's a kind of a privatizing of public work. Mm-hmm. We've seen all those critiques.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if I could just like go back to this, what you mentioned before about the sort of NGOs and using the online space and so on. So in our last episode of the podcast, we had somebody from Nida Hassan from change.org India on. And I was trying to push a bit about, because they celebrate very much issues to do with women, shall we say. They always say all the time, like, okay, you know, it's so great that some women have managed to change this and women have managed to change that. And women are a segment of society that can use like an e-petition platform. And I kept pushing a little bit, I've tried to push a lot when I was telling her, but this is in a way, this sort of, you know, women's issues, or should we say, or gender, it's wonderful for the NGO world, right? Because it's like, yes, everyone wants empowered women. Everyone wants these, you know, everybody knows women are oppressed and et cetera, and so on. And I kept trying to push her, what happens when it you know, conflates or interacts rather with other things such as caste, which people don't like to talk about in the same way, for sure, you know, or class, which people like to possibly even talk about even less. How are you reading this this move now? It's very sort of, can we call it clean, seemingly casteless, seemingly classless, yes, you know, cyber feminism or digital feminism?
Totally, totally. And this is exactly my point. And coming, let's fast forward to 2017, 2016, 17, 18. With the increasing NGOization of even feminist activism in places like India, what was puzzling to me was looking from this side of the world and looking into what was going on. Both, I've been watching the NGO sector on the one hand because I wanted to, again, it's about trying to look at how the subaltern is represented. Because I don't believe I have actual evidence of subaltern speech. I spent a lot of my time in the 90s and early 2000s basically looking for Indian feminism on the internet. Mm-hmm. I enter these spaces through the internet, right? I mean, even when I do offline research, it's always how does this translate into the internet? How does this translate into potential, you know, cyber activism or cyber feminism? So anything I do online that is shadowing an NGO for years and years, or interviewing care workers who are of domestic workers, I do it with the view to what do they do with their digital tools, mm-hmm. and in their everyday. And so in order to understand that, I have to see their offline. And so I'm an ethnographer. I have to see how they do work offline and what they do with it. And I also interview them. So in that sense, there is this offline and online difference, right? Online, I don't see these people. I didn't see these people. And emerge slowly with the populations, whether it's because of the microfinance pitch where the cell phones were, sold as the way to access money, or whether it is through easily cheaper smartphones from Samsung, or whether it is, internet cafes or otherwise. So what happened, I think, all of a sudden was the Indian feminists that I was looking for started to emerge around Web 2.0 time, 2004, 2005. And the reason they started to emerge, I would say, not to be too causal, is that Facebook became accessible to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, the social networking systems that were used by developing world populations were mostly things like Orkut or other, more cheaply available social networking systems.
Aha. Uh-huh. I was wondering, like, as a final question, this project is part of a wider move towards thinking about something that we're calling for the moment digital dignity. And I was wondering, like, is there some way your work might, shed light or reflect on this provocation of digital dignity?
Well, I would say that lack of dignity is what I've been looking at because the other part of what I've been doing is, does the subaltern woman have any agency and autonomy in how she defines herself in these digital environments? And my most recent book was on online philanthropy, connecting microfinancing, and et cetera. What's puzzling is that we can sit here in front of the computer and feel and think, because of the particular NGO discourses that we're seeing, like you said, women are being empowered. There's this autonomous voice coming. But yet when we kind of scratch the surface, the people who are telling us this are the mediators. The people who are defining what the autonomy for these women should be or is being mediated by NGOs or by corporate social responsibility philanthropists. So I would say that I'm not even sure that there is dignity for the people they're representing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that. That's a wonderfully provocative and thoughtful note on which to end the podcast. I'd like to thank you again, Radha, for coming on Online Gods. One of the things I really enjoyed about Radhika's thoughts was her historical perspective on the way concepts, terms, and understandings have changed over time, and yet the same issues, such as empowerment of women, keep on cropping up with all their problematic, depoliticized framings. Well, our next guest has no problem with depoliticized anything. Sophia Ashraf is probably best known as the rapper in the viral YouTube video Kodaikanal Won't. This is a music video about mercury pollution in the town of Kodaikanal in Tamil Nadu in South India, where pollution was caused by a thermometer factory owned by Unilever. The pollution happened back in 2000 initially, and there was an outcry at the time. But over the years, the catastrophe was forgotten, and so an NGO called Jatka.org worked with Sophia to create a rap video that used Nicki Minaj's hit song Anaconda to remind the world about the local town and the issues that they faced. And the video was a massive hit, and it went everywhere, and it really sort of also thrust Sophia into the spotlight, but also showed the ability of using a humorous YouTube video to really force home quite a serious political message. Anyway, Sophia has also done plenty of stuff before and since, creating online content and topics that range from sanitary products to acne. And she's also going to be a keynote speaker at the International Symposium Digital Politics in Millennial India that will take place in Delhi between March 15th and 17th. And that symposium is organized by the wider project of which this podcast is also a part. And it's being organized to discuss the political ramifications of internet-enabled media in India today. In any case, it's my pleasure to welcome Sophia to Online Gods Now. Hi, Sophia, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So now, I mean, I don't know if you'd agree, but we might want to say you're an online star. You have hundreds of thousands of people checking your videos, either on YouTube or on Facebook and so on. But I was wondering, could you first tell us, how did you get here and what's your story?
Well, I actually started off at the age of 18. I used to rap on stage. I used to rap about just my personal identity and what were the social angst that I was facing and whatnot. And I was really lucky at one of the events that I was performing at. There was a volunteer from Vettivere Collective who approached me and said, hey, we run these rock shows where a copyleft platform that calls out governments and corporations that are negligent or flouting human rights or environmental laws, and we use music and art to call them out. And I thought, wow, what a great idea. This is so great. And they told me the words that every artist dies to hear. They said, you can use the stage and be uncensored. Talk about anything that matters to you. And back then, it was right after 9/11, and Islam was deeply under attack. And I was a very strong Orthodox Muslim back then. So I said, hey, I want to use the stage to talk about what Islam really is. And I took to that stage and I rapped about what Islam really meant for a whole generation of us growing up. And I was also introduced to a bunch of environmental disasters that have happened in India, absolute flouting of human rights and laws. So I also wrote some songs about them, and I was hooked. I just love that feeling of getting on stage and writing about something that made me angry. And if you notice, rap is an angry medium. It's a subversive medium. It's a medium of rebellion. So the two just so seamlessly sat together that I was hooked, and that's how I started. I think it all starts with that collaborative effort that an NGO took, where they realized that let's collaborate with a young artist, feed them enough information, and what you will have is a crop of musicians and artists creating art for a cause.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And do you think you would have been able to realize this in a pre-internet age?
Well, actually, this was in a semi-pre-internet age. That this first video that we did, it was actually, we did this on a live platform. We would do it at a rock show. Back then, people went for gigs, you know, that trend is slowly changing now. So this was at a rock show. It was a live event. And one video of this was shot and put online, yes, but primarily it was a very real and live platform. And I honestly don't see much of a difference between then and now. It's just now the new back then the platform was the stage, and now the platform is the internet.
Okay. And I was wondering, like you mentioned before, that you know you had a lot of anger, and rap was a way to sort of get your anger out. But I was wondering, could you talk a little bit more about your motivation? Like, why do you do what you do?
Well, so I'm a writer first. I used to shy away from terms like rapper and activist and all that. I'm a writer, and that's who I consider myself to be. And I enjoy music. And this was just a great way for me to combine two of the things I love, writing and music. And I can't sing. That's a fact of the matter. So I chose to rap. It's a very inspiring story, I'm sure. But I chose rap because I love music, and I enjoyed the rhythm, and I wanted a way to express my angst. And the funny thing is, I am not a confrontational person. If you see my songs, I'm all angry and in your face and subversive. But as a person, I'm kind of like, you know, laissez-faire, and I like, okay, let me hear you out. Let me be calm about this. But somehow the music gives me an outlet to say things that I normally cannot say to people because I'm not a confrontational person. And that's how it all initially started. It was a cathartic medium. And of course, I was a young teenager back then. I had so much of anger in me, all that teenage rebellion. Rap just showed me a way to channelize all that anger. And then now why I continue is now I'm a less angry person, honestly. The older you get, you will notice that you start to let go of your anger and you start to think of other ways of retribution. And in fact, that's why you don't see too many old rappers. You might see old blues musicians. You might see old jazz musicians. But you don't see, you know, graying men sitting and spitting out rhymes, because rap is such an angry medium. But the reason I still keep rapping is because after Kodaikanal Won't, when we released a video on social media talking about an environmental disaster, and it actually made a difference. People sat up and listened, and there was an entire young generation sitting up and listening to music that had purpose, music that had a voice, music that had an opinion. I realized, oh my God, this is a great thing to create, and I don't want to let go. And I just feel the responsibility 100-fold more, because finally there's an entire field, there's a alternative culture rising alongside the mainstream culture, which is just pop and trivial stuff. And I felt I just wanted to be part of it.
This is interesting that you mentioned this last part, this sort of pop culture rising against the mainstream culture, and you're drawing on a lot of the tropes in that with a very political message very often. So what's your how you bring these two together, these sort of very playful YouTube videos that you make about, you know, your mum asking whether or not you're pregnant, or about sanitary products or so on, with the sort of, you know, serious gender politics message, but you're never too serious to say about it. So what's the, how does the creative process work?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. In fact, when we first did Kodaikanal Won't, a lot of people said, hey, this is a really serious issue and you're just using some spoofy poppy song and you're kind of trivializing the issue. But the way I look at it, I come from a background of communication. I've worked in advertising for about 6 or 7 years. So I come from a background of communication. And one of the things all of us, even at the NGO, we've realized really early on was, today people's attention is the greatest commodity that you have out there. Where everyone is fighting for people's attention on a Facebook timeline or an Instagram timeline or a Twitter feed. And who are you fighting against to get those people's attention? You're fighting against corporations with multi-billion dollar advertising budgets. You're fighting with Hollywood and Bollywood and local film industries with multi-million dollar budgets creating fantastic films. You're fighting against the music industry to get someone's attention. Hell, you're also competing with a little kid sitting in his parents' basement and creating a meme. All of this is kind of populating someone's timeline. And you are competing with each other to get that person's attention. So at that point, you need to stop thinking like just an NGO and then start thinking like a communicator and start figuring out, how do I get that person's attention? Because I think the first step is to get their attention. Then once you get their attention, what you do with it, that's a different matter. As Nityanand Jayaram, in one of the producers of the video, says, of the Kodaikanal Won't video, he says, you know, 4 million views does not mean 4 million people better informed. But what we did was, once we got their attention, then we diverted them towards petitions, we diverted them towards explainer videos, we diverted them towards infographics, that out of this 4 million, maybe there might be a million who are actually interested in the issue, and we can probably channel that energy and that attention towards civil action. So I think one of the mistakes a lot of times NGOs do when they try to use protest music or all of that is, they don't realize who they're going up against in order to get people's attention.
And it's interesting you mentioned then that some people were maybe I don't know, worried or upset about the idea that you would, you know, you're basically reinterpreting a song which is about, you know, a rapper who wants big penises, but you're talking about, you're using it about environmental issues, right? And I don't.
One of the reasons I picked Anaconda was I'm a naturally skinny person. I was born really skinny, and this was a song just all about skinny shaming. And then I saw other rap songs which were about fat shaming. And there are rap songs, you know, it's just rap has been used to shame a lot of body types. Mm-hmm. And I thought, hey, why not use rap to shame corporates? You know, if we're shaming someone, why not shame someone who deserves it? So that's why I picked Anaconda. I picked Anaconda. It was already steeped in controversy, and I kind of wanted to put a spin on it.
So can you maybe talk about then if you've ever made like a misstep? Have you ever done something and put it out there and the reaction's just been like, and then you've regretted it maybe?
Yes, definitely. One of the I started a channel called Sister from the South, where I wanted to use music and comedy to talk about women's issues. And one of the first videos I put out was a song called Tambram Boy. A little context to this song. This might be true in other parts of the world also, but women's sexuality is demonized in our country to a point where nobody even talks about the female orgasm. And most of our mainstream culture, all the songs are always about the man wanting, a man having sexual urges or man having desire. A woman's desire is just kept under wraps to a point where it's almost considered a myth that women don't have desires. So this was a song where I wanted to show a woman very openly having desires, where she wants to grab a man and pull him close, you know, things that are not generally sung about in our movies. And I shot it in a very 80s style because that was the time of all the innuendo in songs and all these sultry men singing about how they want their women. And I wanted to make it funny and contextual. So I made it about a South Indian boy. And I added all the South Indian jokes and the tropes and all of the idiosyncrasies of a South Indian boy. And then I made the biggest mistake of my life. I add in another layer, which is I called him a Tambram, which is a Tamil Brahmin. Now, I grew up privileged. I grew up caste blind, where I was taught to ignore caste in a positive way, where they said, okay, don't look at caste. But I also realized that it is caste blindness in a way, because my privilege allowed me the luxury of ignoring caste when there are people who cannot ignore caste. So for me, adding that layer of Tambram wasn't a caste thing, it was a cultural thing. Because I was so privileged, I would hang around with people who made jokes about Brahmins, and it seemed like a cultural thing. But to a lot of people who are way more sensitive to the issue, it looked like I was propagating, hey, this caste is better than other caste, which obviously was not my, that was not what I wanted to do, that was not my intention. Mm-hmm. But still, I realized I had been caste blind, and that's when I realized that nobody's born woke. Nobody's born liberated with socio-political ideas in their head. You learn these things. And that video, being called out for that video, everyone coming out. And I did get a lot of trolls, but I also got sensible criticism. And I realized that, I was wrong. And I put out an apology. And I said, hey, you know what? I realized it was not my intention, but I do realize that this video was caste blind. And in fact, that experience of being called out with so much hate has in fact taught me how to call in people instead of calling them out when they put out videos that might be, which might have a negative message.
That's it's great that you mentioned this sort of the how to respond to hate online. One of the things that we're trying to think about in this podcast with everyone we speak to is whether, I know, the digital sphere or the online space is a good place for dignified debate, like now, not just in India, but anywhere. Do you think it's the case?
Well, we are trying really, really hard with that. And I think the only way to do it is to do it through example. And unfortunately, a lot of us as content creators, because we start off with a lot of anger and we might be liberals, grew up in a society that was extremely oppressive, that it manifests in sarcasm, it manifests in hate, it manifests in wit, which doesn't necessarily lead to, like you said, constructive debate. So what I do is I try to lead by example. If someone calls me out, and I'm tempted, I'm a witty person, I'm tempted to be sarcastic back at them, but I I drink a glass of water and I use love and I write to them and I say, hey, you know what? What you said was hurtful, but here's where I come from. And I have seen in a number of occasions that using love, not being sarcastic, has actually helped develop the debate and has helped that person see my point of view and helped me see their point of view also. So definitely, I think the online sphere is right now not the perfect space for nuanced debate, but we could work towards that if all of us content creators as a whole realize that, you know what, someone who's a troll isn't necessarily brainless. They might have a point of view, maybe hear them out and call them in instead of calling them out.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Sophia, for your answer to this question and all the others. It's been great having you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I think one of the interesting things from that interview that I'd like to highlight is Sophia's moment of reflection when she realised and checked her own privilege. If you have time, search for Tam Bram Boy and look at the comments section, and it really gives you an idea of the sort of politicised energy which can come out when something controversial appears online. And talking of videos, apart from that one, check out all of her other stuff. And I think when you do, maybe like me, you'll wonder if content creator isn't far too dry a term for the sort of stuff that she and others like her do. In any case, that's it from us this week. Rate us on iTunes, retweet us on Twitter, share us on Facebook, and tell all your family members about how wonderful we are, or in case you think so, aren't. As ever, you can find us at 4 Digital Dignity, either with the number 4 or F-O-R, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, etc., 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 or you can drop me an email at onlinegodspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for all your correspondence on last month's podcast. It's always really, really appreciated. Ta-ra! Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online RPOL, funded by the European Research Council, starting grant agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahana Udupa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. This podcast, like all the podcasts, is brought to you in collaboration with the HOW Network for Ethnographic Theory. My personal favourite network for ethnographic theory. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.